Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Of course, that's the wonderful Wes Montgomery. That's 4 on 6, and the great Wes Montgomery was born on this day in 1923. And I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome for the last part of our program here today. As we look at the question of black women in the ivory tower, black women in academia, and it's a huge issue that will be part of a discussion coming up this Sunday at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. And some of the people who are involved in that are joining us here in studio is Dr. Pamela Scott Johnson, the Interim Dean of Liberal Arts here at Morgan State University. Wonderful to have you. Let me get this there closer to you. That good. Lovely to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning.
Glad
to be here.
And Dr. Bonnie Thornton Dill is with us, Dean of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park. And Dr. Dill, welcome. Good to have you with us. Dr. Dill, not there yet? Okay. So I guess she'll be here in just a moment. And Tara Bynum has remained with us. Dr. Tara Bynum is assistant professor in the Department of English at Towson University. And she said, can I stay for this? I really want to get in this conversation. So I said, sure, stay with us. Why not? And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner, email us at talkatsteinershow.org, but call us 410-319-8888. But Dr. Johnson, let me begin with you, and it's a pleasure to have you in the studio here. And I was looking at some articles this morning, just in thinking about this program today. And some of the numbers are shocking, but I think it's not just the numbers. One of the pieces I read was that women in general, but black women specifically, are really not accepted in many ways for intellectual capacity by the public and by their institutions. I think that's a pretty glaring, insipid, and quiet disease.
Indeed it is, Mark. And in fact, as I prepare for Sunday's conversation and took a look at the clips and the video, I actually was reminded about a book that came out about 2 years ago called Presumed Incompetence, The Intersection of Race and Class for Women in the Academy. And one would actually think that the academy would be a lot more open to the ways in which women can be involved and can contribute. But not only looking at these women's stories that have been printed in this book, but also thinking about my own journey and how one copes with that and the types of institutions where we work, there are still a number of issues in terms of women's participation and contribution into the academy.
And one of the things, there was a quote I came across this morning that really kind of struck me in terms of this conversation, and Enosoke Shange's quote. I don't know if you've heard this before, but her quote was, being black and a woman and an academic is a metaphysical dilemma. I thought you would enjoy that.
I think that I definitely enjoyed that, and I think that one of the things that has been troubling, I'm fairly recent, not the most recent kind of graduate, but I graduated in 2009 and had my first assistant professor job start in fall 2008, and I definitely think that not only graduate school, but being now a faculty member and being a faculty member for a little while has been so informative in terms of thinking about how black women are figured in the academy, how my students receive me, how my colleagues receive me. And, you know, I've had a variety of hairstyles and how those hairstyles shape, you know, what they say on student evaluations.
Oh, really?
And having those student evaluations be basically connected to, I would suggest, like, saying that I'm the angry black woman in a variety of ways. So I'm intimidating. I'm a racist was one that I saw. I force my opinions on people. Like, stuff that in actual practice and actual, like, watching what happens in my classroom doesn't entirely make sense, but I think ends up being code for she's an angry black woman, I'm afraid.
Well, so there's sometimes when we just take on what people say and we let it roll off our back, right?
Definitely.
So because I'm an assertive South Carolinian whose mother told me that I could do anything and whose father confirmed it, there are some environments where being considered the angry black woman or the aggressor doesn't bother me. But as I was reminded of not only the data from or the stories of these women, but also looking at women's participation in STEM fields. And so we have all of these dichotomies which have a valence to them: hard science, soft science, humanities, non-humanities. If you're a Black woman who looks conservative, you know, I have my hair in braids, but for the most part, you can't tell. And so when you assert yourself and you are confident about who you are, there are lots of people that will have their judgments regardless. And certainly this conversation takes shape in a predominantly white institution in ways that are dissimilar than those in a Black institution, but by no means are they isolated conversations. Because on our own campus, what we don't talk about on HBCU campuses, we don't talk about the internationalization and the cultural motif of how women are seen and how they are allowed to contribute, it particularly in certain fields. And so while I can say some things, or I know female colleagues will say some things, being said by a person of another gender and another race, even within the Black campus, has a different response to it. I've watched students over several campuses, you know, interact with white professors in different ways than they interact with their Black professors, and where their Black professors have different credentials and more experiences. And so that kind of colorism, mm-hmm. and that kind of genderism is something we all have to be vigilant about, and how we interact from an international framework. We all have to be vigilant, and we have to not be afraid to call it whatever it is, but to move toward the goals that we have. And I think that's more important than anything else, is when you're goal-oriented, you move toward those goals. And I think that's more old school. My oldest stepson is a physician, and I have a daughter who loves to read. The world and the ways that they will interpret how they're hindered, how that'll play out, is very different than when I grew up in the 60s in South Carolina, knowing that there are going to be fights more often than not. And by that, I just mean battles to prove that I'm as intellectually strong and capable as the next person.
Let me introduce you. Also joining us now is Dr. Bonnie Thornton-Dill, who is Dean of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park. Dr. Dill, welcome. Good to have you with us, too.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And I don't know if you were on when I read the Enetsonge Shange quote.
No, I wasn't.
The being Black and a woman and an academic is a metaphysical dilemma. So, and I, when I saw that this morning, it just hit me. It just really, really grabbed me. Especially thinking about you all coming on today and the conference we're having on Sunday. So I wonder if you can talk about what you've just heard Dr. Johnson speak to and Dr. Bynum earlier about, and how that fits into your institution, which is, I mean, because you're in a predominantly white institution.
Right, right. So, and generally when you look at Black faculty as a whole in predominantly white institutions, well, Black faculty are about 5% of the professoriate. And that has not changed a lot in, maybe it was 3% around 1999, but in the last 20 years or so, it really hasn't changed a lot. And so, of course, one of the questions is why? Why hasn't it changed more? I think there are a lot of issues. I think one of the issues that people face in predominantly white institutions is a devaluation of their work and their scholarship. I mean, so not only kind of the biases and prejudices that may come with being Black in a predominantly white environment, but also the fact that people may not see the importance and the value of the topics, particularly in the humanities and social sciences, but even in the sciences that scholars of color may wish to study. Now, scholars of color, I'm not saying that scholars of color only study things related to people of color, but that is certainly a strong interest among scholars of color. And things that are going to benefit their community or the ways in which they engage their students in activities that would benefit their communities is also a strong interest. And those things may not be as highly valued. So people may be suspect both because of who they are and also because of what they do, and that is a source of alienation.
You know, I was thinking about this, and you were coming on here, Dr. Dillon, the chancellor of the University of Maryland, was an African-American for a good period of time. We have the president of two of our large universities here in Baltimore, Kurt Schmokit, the University of Baltimore, and, of course, Freeman Hrabowski at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
Right.
And both of them, there's a dearth of black faculty, especially at UMB, places like UMBC.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is kind of a really telling. And when you look at those numbers, even though those numbers are growing, they're still way underrepresented.
Right.
And especially in at the level that you and Dr. Johnson have achieved, which is being deans of schools, that's even fewer than one would expect. So I wonder. I mean, we talk a lot about systemic racism, implicit racism in America, as these kind of 21st century battles take place. But so how do we begin to address this though in that way? Because I think that one of the key things is something everybody said here earlier is that women in general, but black women in particular. Are not taken seriously as intellectuals in the larger body.
Yes. Well, I think we could do a better job of growing our own, really of having a systematic approaches to the development and promotion and training and nurturing and mentoring of black scholars. From the time they're in undergraduate school. Because, you know, for a lot of African Americans and Latinos, as a matter of fact, but for a lot of African Americans, they don't necessarily come into the academy thinking that they want to be a professor. And it's a lot of times that people find them or encourage them or they learn or encourage themselves or through other friends, like, oh, this is something I would like to do. This is a way I'd like to contribute. How do I do this? For a lot of people, it's an unfamiliar kind of setting. It's not something people don't tell their children, go to college and become a professor. You know, it's like be a lawyer, be an engineer, be things that people are familiar with and they have more experience in with than they know. So I think that we could do some things more systematically really to develop and promote people. And there are some programs, but I think there needs to be more. And then we've also had this in academia. Once somebody gets a PhD, you don't generally hire them at your own institution, at least not at research institutions like the University of Maryland. So people have to go off other places in that field. And maybe maybe you can bring them back or maybe not. But we need to look at that for faculty of color. And then the other thing is I think looking internally within the institution to develop top leadership and to really train and prepare people and see where the talent lies and not assume that the talent is always going to look the same way, that people are going to express themselves the same way, that they're going to be doing the same kinds of things, that they're going to look like others who've been in those positions before, because they're not.
So Dr. Johnson. There are a couple of things to note, and that is several years, Michael Nettles published a book called The Magical Letter PhD, and only about 8% of the working population, maybe even less of the working population, hold PhDs, and far fewer utilize those PhDs within an academic climate. Mm-hmm. The academy is certainly changing, not only as we talk about online education, the cost of a college education. So those external factors certainly impact how people see the academy as a working place. And so having students be interested and gain more exposure, and we seem to be starting these processes earlier and earlier. And as a psychologist and a person who understands a little bit about development, we have left so little time for people to just have fun and grow up. But notwithstanding, there are a number of programs that expose young people to academy life. And I want to be careful as I see some of the young people that we always push. I do not want them to burn out because, you know, they are the people who are going to do our summer programs and who are intellectually gifted, and we continue to push them, and we want them to be exposed. The other part of this is the notion or the issue of training and development. And not only do we see the need to have individuals have the kind of leadership training and background that can be utilized not only within our own institutions but other institutions, but many of the disciplinary organizations see the issue as well. I mean, the American Psychological Association some 15 years ago established a women's leadership institute with the express goal of not only encouraging the leadership in the academy, but also in the disciplinary organizations, because those disciplinary organizations give you entree back into the academic institutions as well as into other areas, because the academy or those organizations want to contribute to the bottom line. And so I know that there are disciplinary organizations. The ACE, the American Council of Education, has a program. Harvard has a program. You know, my own president sent me to HERS, which is the Higher Education Resource Service Network. And another component of this is that as we look at the development of women in the academy and women administrators, we also want to ensure that our voices as women of color and as an African and American women, there are a lot of issues and ways that we're going to address certain things that our other sisters won't. And we're now beginning to have those conversations with our sisters about, you know, every issue that's on the table doesn't look the same for every single woman. And whether they're personal issues, how you administer, how you navigate the system. So these are great points that are being brought up. And we do want to encourage our own internal leadership development, which I do in my college and which we do at the institution, but certainly it could be a lot greater.
And I'm curious, Dr. Tara Bonham is in the studio as well, and I was thinking about this as the other two women were talking. You're entering academia now, in a sense, right, and still an assistant professor, looking for that associate thing at some point in your career. So I just wonder how what you're hearing plays out and how you think it's going to play out.
Well, that's precisely what I was thinking about.
I'm glad to hear that.
So, you know, as I, you're psychic.
Or is it my mother would say psychic? But anyway,
I was thinking. I was one of the undergraduates who did a summer program on a whim and discovered that there was this doctorate that I could get and this life of the mind that I could live. So I've been that undergraduate student, and I think that now that I am the assistant professor, what concerns me more is not just the hiring process, but now the retention process. Mm-hmm. How many of us are getting tenure and promotion, and how many of us are not getting tenure and promotion in ways that seem troublesome and problematic? And, like, what supports are there to go against, not go against, but to ensure that we get to the associate level? And I think that as we think about what Black women in the academy need, not only do we need to ensure that they get there to the graduate program and hired, we also need to make sure that they know their rights and privileges as assistant professors going up for going up for tenure and the protections that they will need and the allies that they will need so that they can then do the programs that get them into deanships and in the provostiary and all the fancy stuff that exists. But I think before we can even begin to think about that leadership and training, how do we make sure that they are properly protected through the tenure and promotion process?
And
may I respond to that?
Oh, Dr. Dill, please go right ahead.
Because I think that's a very a critical question, really. And I know certainly there are two sides to it. There is kind of what the assistant professors need to do and how they need to be strategic in thinking about their careers and thinking about how they negotiate the institution. And there's what the institution needs to do, the kinds of resources that they need to put in place for people. So a couple of examples. I know at Maryland now we have a program called Advancing Together, which has grown out of our grant from the Advance program of NIH, where we are working with faculty of color who are assistant associate professors and really looking at the process of they come together as a group once a month and they look at, they share stories, they build community, they build supports for one another, and they also meet with people and look strategically at the ways in which to advance through the institution. So there need to be more, there need to be programs like that. By the same token, I think I have found that the assistant professors who I know who fared best were also people who were actively seeking out those kinds of resources, who were going to. I've had people come to me and say, I know, I don't know you, you don't know me, but I would like to have coffee with you once a month. I mean, not once a month, once a semester, and just kind of talk about my career here and what I'm doing and what you can tell me about how to negotiate. So they have been people who have, the point of that is that they have sought out senior people and kind of inserted themselves in a way to ask for advice, guidance, support of various kinds. And they know, for example, that some people can give them some kinds of things and some people can give them others. And while you don't want, you know, a whole patchwork quilt of people, you do need to be assertive about those kinds of things. And then you also need to be the same thing as mentoring. I mean, mentoring is a very important part of how people progress. And it is also a two-sided relationship. It is both finding someone who is really going to open doors for you, read papers for you, introduce you to people, as well as help and support your career development, help you build social networks that will advance your career development, as well as really looking out for those people and taking advantage of what they have to offer.
I mean, very quickly get a quick call in here before we have like 5 or 6 minutes left in our conversation when I get this. At least one caller, if we can, at 410-319-8888. And I think it's Leonie at Towson University. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Mark and my fellow sister scholars, thank you so much for this excellent, excellent broadcast. I just wanted to, you guys just said what I was going to ask about, which is basically how to continue to increase and support the pipeline of new scholars and faculty in academia. And basically there was a conference or a couple of conferences several years ago called Black Women in the Academy, where Black women from all over the country came together and really shared stories and strategies. I'd love to see those kinds of things happening more regularly, too, because I think we really do need to support each other.
And let me, we only have like 3 or 4 minutes left, but Dr. Johnson, let me let you jump in.
Yeah, so this issue of mentoring is so critical, and the scholarship is the key to everything, whether you remain at your institution or whether or not you are viable in other institutions. It's not only incumbent upon you to seek us out, but it's incumbent upon us as institutional leaders to develop a framework for you to not not only meet your colleagues and establish writing groups. So I have two young women in the Department of History who have received scholarships, but they also have writing groups that they hold themselves accountable. And it's also incumbent upon me as an administrator to make sure that I establish relationships and partnerships. And then the what was also mentioned was the advance program. I really want to make a plug because this is our tax dollar at work, and that is the National Science Foundation, through many other means, have really helped us address the increasing the number of women in the academy and in STEM. And then, Mark, I just want to put a plug in for two things. One is there's a Women of Color conference that's held in June every year. I'd be happy to put that link on board. And it really is not your same kind of science meeting where you hear a lot of stuff. And also for our own intersection conference tomorrow here on Morgan's campus.
Yes, we had those. Dr. Annika Simpson was on with other people for that conference. We're on this program just this week earlier.
Great.
And I always say when I hear the three of you here and other people in this program, I feel like we in this Mark Steiner show here at WEA live in this rarefied atmosphere because we always have these brilliant, scholarly, and activist African-American women on this program talking. So it feels like, you know, it's everywhere, but then the reality it's important to have this conversation in real reality. We are in this rarefied atmosphere, and it doesn't spill out over into the larger world, which it has to. So I want to thank Dr. Bonnie Thornton-Dill, who is Dean of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park, for being here, and Dr. Pamela Scott-Johnson, Interim Dean of Liberal Arts College at Morgan State University, and Dr. Tara Bynum, who stayed with us, Assistant Professor of English at Towson University. And reminding you, you can meet many of these women this Sunday, March the 8th at 2 p.m. As part of the Women's History Month, they're hosting a film and panel discussion at the Reginald Lewis Museum downtown. And Living Thinkers, an autobiography of black women in the ivory tower will be shown. And then a discussion will be taking place. And Dr. Dillon and Dr. Johnson, along with Dr. Kay Whitehead, who's on the show a great deal, will be part of that discussion. So thank you all for being here in the studio. It's been great.
Thank you.
And for joining us by phone. And on the way out here, I remind you that please write to Valerie, V-A-L-E-R-I-E, at steinershow.org to ensure that you can take part in our focus group on March 19th to make Soundbites a better project for all of us to be part of. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Engineers Andre Melton. Our intern and Dan History Research producer is Sienna Greaves. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. We're hearing Eclipse by Pink Floyd. Dave Gilmour of Pink Floyd was born on this day in 1946. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.